Doctors at work today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. On this Labor Day, two doctors who went beyond the call of duty. One helped treat migrants who risked their lives crossing the Mediterranean.
They're all crushed into these dinghies. Two or three people are shown how to use outboard and they're told to sail north.
And in India, the doctor who did what she had to do to prove HIV was becoming an epidemic there.
She had collected all these samples from 80 prostitutes and she put it in her refrigerator because there was no other place to store it.
Plus, good news, giant pandas are no longer endangered. Bad news, eastern gorillas are.
We are the only great ape that are not facing extinction at the moment, but if we keep going the way we are, we could be putting ourselves at risk.
Those stories, plus our community of veterans, weighs in on hearing loss today on The World. Happy Labor Day to all of you. One of the last days this summer, I expect you'll be heading to the pool. We're actually going to hear about how Germany is handling a culture clash at its swimming pools. New refugee arrivals have meant a different vibe this summer at German municipal pools. More on that in a few minutes. First, though, the treacherous waters of the Mediterranean that thousands of people have to face before they get to Europe. It is a perilous journey. Just last week, the Italian Coast Guard rescued 10,000 migrants in only 2 days, and those are the ones who survived. The sheer number of people attempting the journey overwhelms most of the efforts to help them. Many people, though, are lending a hand anyway. Dr. Javed Abdelmonheim is a British doctor who spent time this summer on a Doctors Without Borders rescue boat patrolling the seas between Libya and Italy. He joins me now from London. Can you just walk us through your daily routine on the boat doing rescues?
Yeah, hello there. Yes, usually the rescues would be between 8 and 11 o'clock in the morning because they tend to set sail themselves in, under the cover of darkness after midnight from the beaches of Libya. Mm. So the rescues would occur between 8 and 11 a.m. They would be quite sort of tense operations. We don't want the people on the rubber dinghies to panic or to try and swim for us or to be afraid of who we are, a large vessel approaching. And so we send out two very small ribs, sort of rigid little boats with three people on each. And we speak Arabic, English, French, and one of the Tigrinya, which is a language from Eritrea, Somalia, between us. And we give them messages to say that they're safe. We give them life jackets. And we would do a sort of first pass triage and try and make eye contact or at least speak to everybody that's on this dinghy, see if there are any dead people, any pregnant women, any people that look that they're severely in distress. Once everyone was off safely off the rubber dinghy, and that would be sometimes up to 140 people.
And if their dinghy, if their boat is overcrowded, I mean, it must be pretty risky trying to approach them. We hear a lot about these stampedes and then the boat just sinks.
Very, very. The rubber dinghies themselves are very small, very easily overwhelmed by water, and they have very unsafe bases. They're not rigid, so to speak, and they can easily break and collapse in on themselves and actually cause crushes. So they're not seaworthy in any way.
So these boats actually making it from Libya to Italy, is that the norm or is it the exception?
Oh, no boats make it to Italy.
None?
None. These rescues are really all occurring just inside international waters, outside of Libyan territorial waters. None of these boats will actually stand any chance of making it to Italy. It's a two-day sail, even with our ship, let alone a rubber dinghy.
You know, every one of those boats is filled with unreal human stories of escape and what people faced back in the countries they fled. Any people who you met in those boats that really stand out in their stories?
The very first patient I treated on my very first rescue, I think there were some 139 people in the first rubber dinghy we rescued, and 40 of them were Nigerian women. And we know, like, people are being trafficked, or these people are being moved with a purpose, and someone somewhere is benefiting by moving them. Nigerian girls essentially are the worrying group that you look for. And this was a group of 40. And essentially, they're being moved to Italy to enter sex slaves. And they will never see the money. They're not prostitutes. They're sex slaves. And the very first patient in that group was a young girl. She said she was 22. She looked a lot younger. And in fact, afterwards, she told me her birthday was the next day. Mm. And she was turning 18. who had been raped the night before by two Arab men. She told me that she had been in detention in Libya for some 2 to 3 months in a room with 92 other people. And the night before, she had been taken out of that room with three other women, beaten around the head and legs with metal piping, and was forced to have sex with two men against her will. And she'd lost her front two teeth and had bruising all around her legs. And of course, once she signaled then that she's, on this day she was a minor, then we can also make sure that she had extra care and protection. Because, you know, when you have a group of women traveling like this, they're all told to say they're above 21 so that they're not put in protection, so that whoever's receiving them in Italy has access to them. And it's dark. It's very dark.
Yeah. And she was your first patient. Horrific.
She was my very first patient. And these, Nigeria, I don't know how much you know about Nigerians, but they always had such lovely names like Blessing and Precious and Hope and Joy. And she had a name that was like that, but it was so opposite to the life that she was living.
Javed, is there a weird catch-22 here? Because the traffickers kind of depend on rescuers as part of their business plan to get people across the sea. Did you ever have a sense that maybe your rescue efforts were contributing to the problem at the same time that you were helping?
I think that's certainly a thought that enters one mind. But actually, the reality is that the traffickers don't care for what happens to those souls that they put in those rubber dinghies. Once they are in the rubber dinghies and have set sail, they don't care if they're dead or alive, and there will be no repercussion for them if all of them die. And I get a very strong sense from speaking to every one of the people that we rescued. We have 2 days till we sail back to Italy. And over those 2 days, they see that we're sailing at full speed and they see the distance and the size of the waves. And I always made it a point just to sort of, tease out what they thought about this journey. And I said, guys, do you look at the distance we've covered in these last 2 days to arrive here in Italy? Do you think you would have made it in that boat? And universally, no, I had no idea. I had no idea the sea was that big. There's no way we would have survived. And you can see the shock on their face when that reality dawns. And the smugglers are taking advantage of that ignorance. They say, yes, either you'll be saved or you'll get there. They're not told that it's such a perilous journey. And there may have been 2,700 deaths counted so far this year, but they're people that are counted. We don't know that you're reaching everybody and every rubber dinghy. You know, bodies sink after a while. And some 110, 120, I forget the number right now, washed up on the shores of Sabratha, the city in North Libya, just in the month of July alone. And they're just the bodies that come back to shore. So we don't know how many are dying.
British doctor Javed Abdelmonheim worked on a Doctors Without Borders rescue boat patrolling the Mediterranean this summer. Thanks very much for the interview and thanks for your work.
Pleasure. Thank you.
In France, the burkini continues to be caught up in controversy. Burkini is shorthand for the all-body swimsuit that some Muslim women wear at beaches for modesty. It's all tied up in France's secular sense of identity and growing fears about Muslim immigrants. Germany is struggling with some of the same issues. Over the past year or so, it's been trying to integrate more than 1 million asylum seekers from the Middle East, and some of the tension is playing out at swimming pools. Daniel Estrin has a story from Berlin.
One of Berlin's largest pools on Columbiadamm Street is near two refugee housing centers, which means that new arrivals from places like Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan, and longtime Berlin residents all swim here together. Before the start of swimming season this summer, social worker Hartmut Kurzals was bracing for trouble with the refugee swimmers.
They don't know how to behave. Most of them know, but some of them don't know.
Kurzals helps run Bleib Cool am Pool, staying cool at the pool. It's a group of conflict mediators, many from immigrant backgrounds, who patrol the pool. This summer, the group has been trying to help refugees learn about German pool culture. Rule number one, don't touch the women.
If they see a young woman lying only with a bikini, so they think, yeah, maybe I can attract her.
Germans have been concerned about sexual assault by asylum seekers since a notorious incident on New Year's Eve in the city of Cologne, when hundreds of cases of harassment were reported. At least two men have since been convicted. One German town banned adult male migrants from its public swimming pool this winter. But it's not just about gender. All newcomers are being asked to adopt German hygiene standards, says Arne Freudenberg of Staying Cool at the Pool.
Just to explain the rules could be sometimes very difficult. Just to say, at first, if you want to go inside a pool, you have to clean yourself. And they just said, what do you want from me? They didn't even understand that at first they have to have a shower.
Na, am meisten sind die halt bei dem Becken, weil es ein Kinderbecken ist. Das Wasser ist halt nur ganz...
Nurjan Jevelik is one of the conflict mediators. She's of Turkish background. She says it's a problem when Muslim mothers wear long clothing at the pool. You'll have women who will come and hold their kids at the edge of the pool, and their cloth dips into the water, she says. You can only imagine how unhygienic that is. Unlike in France, burkinis are encouraged for Muslim women in Germany, since they're made out of swimming suit material and therefore considered hygienic. Here's another dilemma with refugees at the pool. Many don't know how to swim. Nurjan says she recently saved a 14-year-old Afghani refugee boy from drowning.
Wenn wir zu denen sagen, ihr dürft nicht in diesem Becken reingehen.
They're 13, 14, 15 years old, she says. They don't like to be told they can't swim. German pools have been trying to teach refugees how to act at pools in the most German way they can. Friendly cartoon instructions posted on pool walls and handed out at refugee centers. The most important thing, says Korzals, is to make newcomers understand that in Germany there are rules and no exceptions.
I think one German line is, if you say no, it means no.
German swimming pools are a metaphor for Germany and for the challenge of integrating newcomers. Germany is one big swimming pool. Syrian refugee Jaber Zahar el-Din says he thinks German efforts to teach his fellow refugees swimming etiquette is a very good idea. He says he's seen a lot of dangerous pool jumping, including by fellow Syrians.
Ich glaube, dass die, weil die Zuhörer nicht die
the Syrians don't keep the rules, he says. They just want to jump anywhere. And this attitude plays a part in the statistics. In the last couple years, there have been reported cases of refugees drowning in Germany. Also, Zahar el-Din says Syrians need to learn to respect German body culture. If Arabs see a woman wearing a bikini, they have to accept it. And Germans who see a woman with a hijab have to accept it as well. When I met the German pool mediators at the beginning of the summer, they had concerns about major culture clashes at the pool. Now swimming season is nearly over, and Freudenberg says it's been quiet. The main thing people at the pool have complained about, he says, are lost property and insect bites. And there's been a lot of mutual respect. A 22-year-old girl in a bikini who gave her name as Leticia said she doesn't mind seeing burkinis.
I think it's like the culture of the country, so I respect that. Don't judge people.
For all the fear about sexual harassment by the pool, only a handful of incidents has been reported this summer. But still, this pool and others employ tough-looking security guards in black uniforms. The guards are Middle Eastern themselves to help keep Middle Eastern refugees in line. For The World, Daniel Estrin, Berlin.
Tomorrow we'll take a look at how German schools are integrating refugees. This recent college graduate was drafted to teach a special welcome class for 16 kids in a small town south of Berlin.
My job here is to show them how beautiful the world can be, that they are safe here. That's really important for the children. I really want to fight for them.
But even then, learning German and fitting in are a challenge. That's tomorrow on the show. You're with The World.
Support for The World's podcast comes from Goldman Sachs for answers to the world's most pressing economic questions, from the latest in emerging markets to finding the next big computing platform. Tune into Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, the firm's podcast. Each episode features in-depth discussions with some of the firm's leading experts on the markets, evolving industries, and the global economy. Subscribe to Exchanges at Goldman Sachs on iTunes, Stitcher, or SoundCloud, or listen at gs.com/podcast.
30 years ago, HIV was largely thought of as a Western disease that almost exclusively affected gay men. People in India certainly saw it that way. So it was shocking for them when the virus turned up in their own socially conservative country. Perhaps as surprising was the way the virus was discovered in the first place. A young Indian microbiology student was looking for a topic for her dissertation. My BBC colleague Geeta Pandey in Delhi has written a profile of that microbiologist. Her name is Selipan Nirmala. But before we get to her story, Geeta, let's start with the climate in 1985. India hadn't really done anything to prepare for HIV or AIDS. Tell us why that was.
Exactly. I mean, Indians, we were thinking that, okay, this is a disease of the debauched West, you know, where free sex and homosexuality is prevalent. And they were thinking, okay, we are very God-fearing, we are heterosexual and monogamous. And, you know, there's no way that we can have HIV AIDS here.
So this young student, who is now Dr. Nirmala, she decides to start looking into HIV and begins interviewing prostitutes. Tell us why she did that.
You know, she actually was very, very reluctant because, you know, everybody was writing about it, saying prevalence of AIDS in India is unthinkable. So she was very reluctant to take it up when her professor, she suggested that you take this up as your dissertation topic. So she agreed reluctantly and she started hanging around the general hospital. And there she befriended a couple of prostitutes, sex workers. So then she started interviewing these women and started talking to them and essentially started collecting their blood.
I gather that Dr. Nirmala was a very shy person, and suddenly she's interviewing prostitutes and trying to convince them to give her their blood. What was that like?
This is the most interesting bit of the story, that she was like just somebody you couldn't really imagine who would be hanging around with sex workers, because she came from a small village. She was very shy, very reticent. She was just about 32 years old. She was married. She already had two small children. So for her to actually go out and hang out with sex workers was something that was unthinkable. But the most fascinating bit is that she did it.
So I know the testing facilities in India for blood were pretty rudimentary at the time. She took that blood to her home and stashed it in the fridge.
Yes, it's, you know, it was amazing because she said she took the blood samples. Mm-hmm. Now, the big thing was there was no testing facility for HIV. For that, they had to travel 200 kilometers away. And then one fine day, she and her husband, they put all those samples in an ice box. They took an overnight train from where they took an auto rickshaw and they drove to this laboratory, and that's where it was tested. And she said that, you know, when the result came out, she said we were stunned.
How did Indians react? Was there a kind of a sense of denial that this can't be our country?
There was massive denial, complete and utter shock. Everybody said the doctors must have made a mistake, right? But there was no mistaking it. This had to be actually taken up. Then India had to start tackling the HIV, you know, the virus.
Dr. Nirmala, though, I mean, she's largely forgotten for her contribution to understanding HIV in India. Maybe she potentially saved many lives. How does she feel about all this?
Actually, I really got goose pimples when I heard her story, right? The fact that she did all of this at the time is something that's absolutely stunning. But the fact is that she spent the rest of her working career sort of working in the vaccine department or having a quiet life, bringing up two children. And I did ask her about this. I said, do you not feel that you did not receive the recognition that, you know, you deserve? She said, I'm happy that I got this opportunity to serve people and do something. And, you know, that is my reward.
Very unassuming. That's my BBC colleague, Geeta Pandey in Delhi. Thank you very much for telling us about Dr. Nirmala.
Thank you, Marco.
Here's a rare piece of good news on conservation. Pandas are no longer on the endangered species list. That's according to the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Pandas are now on its vulnerable list, which is a step up. I have Craig Hilton Taylor, who's with the IUCN, on the line. This is pretty great news. How excited are you?
Oh, we're extremely excited because normally we have to say, give bad news to the world about how many species are slipping away towards extinction. So it's always great to be able to celebrate a conservation success to show how we can turn things around.
And when we say the pandas are now only vulnerable, what does that mean? What do they face?
So they're not out of risk yet. So they are still, we have to maintain conservation efforts around them. We have to maintain all the current efforts that are being done. The Chinese authorities are doing a fantastic job. But the real concern is that climate change could impact the species in the future. looking at, the giant panda is very dependent on bamboo as its main food source, and looking at the climate change models, they are projecting that the bamboo that the panda favors, 35% of that bamboo could disappear in the next 80 years. So, we can't afford to be complacent. We have to look at how we can mitigate against that and work with the Chinese authorities to put in place the right conservation actions to prevent any further declines and reverse all the good work that's been done to date.
The panda, as you know, Craig, has kind of become this icon for conservation, almost a brand. I mean, it is a brand for the World Wildlife Fund. That is its logo, a panda. Do you think that's helped the panda?
Absolutely, yes. But, you have to view the panda as a... It's an iconic species, but the area where it occurs in China is an extremely biodiversity-rich area. And by protecting all the habitat for panda has helped to conserve habitat for many, many, many thousands of other species. So it's really an umbrella species for conservation.
So good news for pandas today, but bad news over the weekend, as you know, for the endangered mountain gorilla. Tell us what happened. What was announced?
Yes, so the mountain gorilla has moved from endangered into the critically endangered category. So it has an extremely high risk of going extinct in the near future unless we do something about it. And that's all because of, or primarily because of overhunting for bushmeat and for the pet trade. The population has declined by more than 70% in the last 20 years. And so the numbers now are about 5,000 animals left in the wild.
Mountain gorilla is basically a genetic relative of us, Homo sapiens, right?
That's correct, yes. So four of the six great apes now are one step away from extinction. We are the only great ape that are not facing extinction at the moment. But if we keep going the way we are, we could be putting ourselves at risk.
Yeah, so why can't we get the same attention for the mountain gorilla as we've gotten for pandas?
So certainly there's a huge amount of effort being put into mountain gorilla conservation work. It's just a very difficult part of the world to do conservation because it's in Central Africa where there's lots of civil strife, civil war. The species occurs in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, and Uganda. But there are a number of conservation organizations on the ground trying to work with government to put in the right measures. It's very tricky for the national parks rangers. They're constantly fighting to protect the gorillas, but they're putting their own lives on the stake. And a few rangers have been killed over the years as they come into contact with poachers. So it's a very tense situation, but I'm sure with the right efforts between governments, conservation organizations, and even the local communities, we can turn the mountain gorilla around and have the same kind of success as we see with the giant panda.
Have you ever noticed any strange dynamic, like actually, news about the pandas being now off the endangered species list, on the vulnerable list? Could it actually hurt future preservation efforts? Like now that it's off the endangered list, pandas might not be a priority anymore.
No, definitely not. So that's the big message we're trying to put out, saying, they've moved down a category from endangered to vulnerable, but they are completely conservation dependent. If we stop conservation actions now, the panda would slip back into endangered and probably even go to critically endangered very, very quickly.
Craig Hilton-Taylor with the International Union for Conservation of Nature. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Pleasure.
Later on the show, your Labor Day barbecue may help you figure out what to do with that leftover kimchi in your fridge here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Georgetown University tries to make amends for slavery. Some think the school should do more, but this South African says it's a good start.
What Georgetown is in fact saying is there is unfinished business, and we are going to, as a university, deal with that unfinished business.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and it's The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. South Africa has been through it. Sierra Leone followed suit. I'm speaking about truth and reconciliation, dealing with a country's tragedies by getting all the players together and essentially talking it out until you can move forward together. And in a way, that's what Georgetown University is now doing. When slavery was legal in the U.S., Georgetown sold slaves for a profit. Last week, Georgetown announced that it would offer preferential admissions to the descendants of those slaves and that they create an institute for the study of slavery. So we thought we'd talk with someone who knows something about truth, reconciliation, and reparations. Jonathan Jansen is the chair of the Institute of Race Relations in South Africa. Currently, he's also a fellow at Stanford. In fact, he just arrived in the U.S. this morning. So, Jonathan, welcome to the show and to your new year-long position at Stanford. Thanks for being here.
Thank you very much.
I'm just curious, you feel like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission could be successfully imported to the U.S. from South Africa to address not just the current spate of police killings of black youth, but to really get to a national discussion of what 300 years of slavery led to in this country?
Yeah, you know, every context is different, of course, but I do think there is validity across contexts around the very simple concept of truth and of reconciliation. That is, of having people come together from rival segments of a community and sort of saying, let's talk about what happened in the near or distant past, and let's figure out how we can deal with that past in a way that both speaks to the issue of social justice, but also to the issue of reconciliation. And I don't know of another way of getting towards those twin goals except by bringing people around a table for purposes of truth-telling. So yeah, I think there is great value in that. Now, of course, there are problems with all of this, as you know. I mean,
one I was going to ask you, what do you think the Truth and Reconciliation was unable to address?
Yeah, so the one thing it didn't do and comes in for a lot of criticism two decades later is not everybody came forward.
In other words, not enough people came out and told the truth.
Not enough white people came out and said, whether it's as individuals or as part of the state machinery, to sort of say this is what actually happened. And I think to some extent that's to be expected. I mean, you know, it's unrealistic to expect people who've done horrible things to all rush forward and say, let me tell you what I did. Mm. But at least there were enough people from the clergy, from the business world, from the police forces who came and said, I can't take this anymore. I need to talk. I need to get this off my chest. And that created grounds, you know, for victims then to come forward and say, you know, I hear you. It hurts me. You did a terrible thing. But let me reach out to you and see whether we can move forward. And to the extent that that happened, whether it was for 10, 20, 100 families among millions, that, because it was televised, because it was so on such public display, a whole lot of ordinary people said, you know what, I can relate to that. That makes sense to me. I think I can begin to deal with my own demons, whether as a perpetrator or a victim. Now, my view of the TRC is a little different from most of my friends in South Africa in that I don't believe that was all supposed to be accomplished in 2 or 3 years, you know. I really believe that was supposed to be the starting point for an ongoing dialogue, because you can't unravel centuries of pain and suffering, of hurt and violence in the stipulated time given for the TRC, as we called it, to hold its hearing. So in my work, certainly as a university president for several years, I saw it as my task, where I worked with 30,000 students and faculty, to create opportunities for us to continue the work of Truth and Reconciliation. And I believe that should be the responsibility of communities long after the official televised performance, if you will, of Truth and Reconciliation took place.
We've been talking about Truth and Reconciliation. I just want to ask you about reparations, which is, I know, is another huge discussion. But this recent move by Georgetown University to give preferred admission status to descendants of slaves does feel more in the realm of reparations. What are your thoughts about what Georgetown has proposed?
I am so proud of Georgetown University. You know, I think the famous aphorism that the past isn't dead, it isn't even past, you know, and I think that is true. So what Georgetown is, in fact, saying is there is unfinished business, and we are going to, as a university, deal with that unfinished business. You know, you can't just do reparation. You also have to first acknowledge wrong. So what I'm hoping is that they have a process in which there is a public acknowledgement of wrongdoing. That is so important for victims, quite apart from whatever you might do on the material side of the ledger, but just acknowledging we have done wrong, and we therefore want to make it right. And we recognize that nothing we can do on the material side can fully repair the damage, but this is an attempt to reach out to communities. And what they've done, as I understand, is to say that those people who are descendants of slaves with connections to the Georgetown community would be able to study at the university. I think that's beautiful. And I'm hoping that all universities that have been affected by this, universities in South Africa, like my own, a former white university, would in fact be able to have the humility and the grace to acknowledge that that shadow of the past still haunts us and we can do something about it.
Is truth and reconciliation a necessary prelude to reparations? And do you think reparations is kind of a final bill for some kind of future truth and reconciliation commission in this country?
In any country, I think that is exactly what it is. It is the end of a process. It's not the beginning of a process. In the South African experience, many of the victims of violence and people who lost their children and their loved ones weren't actually asking for money. They weren't asking for material reparation. They were saying, just tell me what happened. Mm. Just acknowledge that you were there. Just connect with me at a very human level with the truth. And I think that is a much, much greater need amongst people. And so, yeah, I think reparations is necessary. It's vital. But it is the consequence of other things happening first, and that is truth-telling.
So fill in the blank for us as a South African. The sentence is, the longer you wait to hold a Truth and Reconciliation Commission for slavery in America, what?
Well, the longer you wait, the more difficult it is to create peace among peoples and to create justice in impoverished communities. The longer you wait, the more hardened people's hearts become and the more difficult it is for public officials to convince those communities that they act in their interests. The longer you wait, the longer you postpone a sense, a lingering sense of justice for those left out because of the past. And so I think not just in the United States, in South Africa, all over the world, in Rwanda as we speak, in the former Yugoslav republics, the longer you wait to deal with it, the more difficult it becomes going forward.
Jonathan Jansen, thanks very much for your time today. Welcome to the United States for a year.
Thank you very much.
Jonathan Jansen is the former vice chancellor and rector at the University of the Free State in South Africa. He's now a fellow at Stanford University. If you can't fight City Hall, join them. That's a lesson some young activists learned, apparently, in Hong Kong. 2 years ago, massive student-led protests erupted in the Chinese territory, but in the end, those demonstrations calling for more autonomy for Hong Kong failed. China refused to compromise and played a waiting game. The protests fizzled out. But now some of those same young activists who helped lead those 2014 protests have won seats in a Hong Kong citywide election over the weekend. We've got the world's Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen on the line to break it down for us. How does Beijing feel about this, Patrick, especially while it's hosting world leaders at the G20 and in Hong Kong, the Pepsi generation is getting elected?
Well, they can't be feeling too good about it. There are now about six candidates in the Hong Kong legislature that openly say, let's have a referendum and see if Hong Kong should go independent, which is pretty much Beijing's worst nightmare. So, you know, it's only six people, but they have a really big public profile. They're really feisty young people. And yeah, Beijing's probably not very pleased.
Yeah. So some of these young activists want to go all the way back to the past and have Hong Kong be independent from China. That sounds pretty different. What else is different about these young people who've been elected to the Legislative Council in Hong Kong?
Well, there has always been a pro-democracy crowd in Hong Kong, and there's always been pro-democracy candidates in Hong Kong's legislature. But there's a difference between the old guard and the new guard. So the old guard would say, yes, we want more say in how Hong Kong is governed, and we want more democracy. But, you know, of course, we have to work with China. We're a part of China. And this young crowd, they practically portrayed China as enemy number one to Hong Kong citizens. I mean, they'll straight up say, we need independence. You know, I met with this in the run up to the election. I met with this young woman, about 19, who's one of the senior secretaries at one of these new parties that got elected. Demasisto is the name. They have very trendy names. And she says that they assume that they're being monitored. They assume that their phone calls are being tapped, that their emails are being read. They fear getting abducted. They have no love for the Communist Party.
Meantime, don't you have essentially a quota of Beijing-approved candidates and council people on that legislative council?
Yes, I would not like to make it out that Hong Kong's legislature does not have, you know, lots of pro-Beijing candidates. You know, the legislature itself is quite odd. In fact, it's so odd that every time there's an election, newspapers have to come out and explain how it works. So you can vote in your district, and also there are these seats that are voted on by corporations based on your sector, like banking or insurance. So corporations choose some of the seats, and they can reliably be pro-Beijing seats.
So what will these young, now elected officials to the Legislative Council in Hong Kong actually be able to do?
Well, they ran on this platform saying that there should be a referendum for independence. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. I think what they've got now is a foothold. polls show that about 1 in 6 people in Hong Kong want independence, which doesn't sound like so many. But if you look at the 15 to 24 year old segment, it's more like 40%. That's nearly half. So that segment is going to grow older. And eventually there are going to be more and more candidates voted into this legislature that are talking openly about referendums for independence. I mean, Beijing sees this as is just awful, awful stuff. I mean, it's only going to validate their worst fears about Hong Kong as this feisty place with radical political ideas.
If Beijing didn't seem to have this control over the Legislative Council, do you think there would be more candidates today and more people electing them who push for a democracy agenda?
Oh, absolutely. There were actually 5 or 6 candidates that were not allowed to run because their calls for independence were too strong. So the people that won were saying more like, let's have a referendum for independence. If you came right out and said Hong Kong should be an independent nation tomorrow, you weren't even allowed to run.
Still, this kind of feels like a sign that those protests 2 years ago, the umbrella movement, that it's really not over and just kind of continuing at Hong Kong City Hall right now. Am I wrong about that?
No, you're not wrong. I think people that are politically animated are becoming more animated around this idea of, if not independence, just a bigger pushback to China. There are all these new parties, like I mentioned, with trendy names called Demasisto and Youngspiration. And it's not just young people that are into this stuff. You know, the older crowd, people that are 50 plus, that would not be considered, you know, this young vanguard. You know, a lot of them are really cheering these young people on.
The World's Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Let's return now to something we talked about last week on the show, hearing loss among military veterans. Ryan Bradley wrote about it for The New Republic, and he told us an estimated 60% of Iraq and Afghanistan war vets suffer from it.
When you can't hear, or when you have a ringing in your ear, or when even, you know, slight noises set off severe headaches, it's really hard to interact with people in a normal way, and it's really hard to just re-enter society.
Since then, our online community of veterans have been sharing their hearing loss experiences with us. My ears ring all the time, writes one vet from Eugene, Oregon. Another named Chad writes, I miss a lot of conversation and I'm often embarrassed to ask people to repeat themselves. There was a vet who wrote that his hearing loss has cost him employment with a freight company. When it comes to what caused the damage, often it's noise from aircraft, shoulder-fired missiles, operating a 50-caliber machine gun in combat. But not all ear injuries happen during combat.
When I was in the Navy on Guam working in teletype maintenance, the chief took me to transmitters. There was a giant transmitter tube, and the closer we got to it, the pain in my ears got greater. The closer I got, I could tell that the pain was coming from that transmitting tube. And tears hurting. I just shouted at the chief, pain's hurting me. I got to get out of here. And I ran out of there. But to this day, I can still feel that pain that hit inside my ears. It was horrible.
We had a Vietnam War vet write to us and say he's had no hearing loss issues. I always wore my earplugs. But that's not always an option in military settings, according to one vet named Joseph.
They give you earplugs every unit you've ever been in, basic training on. They give you earplugs to wear. There's no excuse to have hearing loss. But, I know, some soldiers don't want to miss any noises they might need to hear. So sometimes they're catch-22.
A Marine who served in Afghanistan said he did not wear earplugs. He wrote, I have 26 decibel hearing loss in my left ear and 17 in my right. I was a machine gunner deployed to Helmand Province. And here's Eric, who served in the Navy.
I'm wearing hearing aids because of hearing loss due to the damage caused at that point in my life. I'm a 43-year-old man, and I get to navigate the wonderful world of not being able to hear everybody around me. It's an interesting challenge, and my hearing loss hasn't measured up to the standards that the veterans covers yet as benefits. So I have to wait for it to get worse before the VA will step in and assist me.
And unfortunately, experts say that vets who have hearing loss will find that the deafness gets worse over time. Finally, one vet from San Jose, California, describes hearing loss as a double-edged sword. Their quote, the absence of accountability for listening to everyone else's nonsense is the bliss of losing your hearing. Seeing the silver lining inside that cloud, for sure. We always want to hear from our online community of veterans. You can join the community by texting RETURN, the word return, to 69866. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Whole lot of talk about taco trucks in the past few days. If you missed it, one of Donald Trump's boosters, Mexican-American Marco Gutierrez, told MSNBC that unlimited immigration would lead to the Hispanicization of America.
My culture is a very dominant culture, and it's imposing and it's causing problems. If you don't do something about it, you're going to have taco trucks every corner.
A taco truck on every corner. That's gotten Gutierrez a lot of flack. Many Hispanics have lashed out saying Gutierrez is self-loathing, while many other Americans are saying, how cool would it be to have a taco truck on every corner? The World's Maria Muriel met Marco Gutierrez at the Republican National Convention in July and has been in touch with him again. So how's Gutierrez feeling about his comment now, Maria?
He told me he's been loving the attention. I asked him if he regrets saying the phrase, and he said no, but he does wish that he had worded it differently.
Yeah, so what do you think he was trying to say?
Well, I spoke to him at length, and his reasoning for saying that is a feeling that I know a lot of immigrants actually do have, that when you come to this country, it might be best to actually lie low and assimilate.
Yeah, but a lot of people have said he may have taken that too far.
Yeah, you know, along with the feeling I just mentioned goes the thought among some immigrants that they're so happy to leave their old country behind because it was so bad. And by coming to the States, what you get is actually to completely let go of everything negative about your old country. He sort of explained it to me in these terms.
You're going to have taco trucks outside the White House and piñatas, and that's usually what I say. It's sort of like a joke, but I'm just trying to describe that as Hispanics, we are running away from a world that has problems. And when we come here, we replicate those problems.
Kind of a joke, Gutierrez says. But Maria, you've tapped into another kind of thinking among immigrants, that assimilation is necessary.
Yeah, this is not new, right? Unfortunately, this is something that a lot of immigrants from all kinds of cultures have experienced, the feeling that they need to blend in because that is the way you survive. And again, you know, I lived in South America for most of my childhood, and I do know and I experience that a lot of people in Latin America do feel like the mainstream white culture of the United States is sort of something to aspire to, and that if you can be most similar to that, then you'll be better off in life.
Right. And you brought this up with Marco Gutierrez. Let's hear that.
It sounds a little bit like you feel that American equals white, the white culture that we know as the majority culture in this country.
I think everybody thinks that. Everybody I talk to.
I disagree with Marco here. Not everybody thinks that. Like, not everybody feels like you need to be white in order to be successful or in order to have a good life in this country or in any country. But this is not a feeling unique to him. There are some people who feel like this is what's necessary to come to a country and be successful and to achieve the American dream everybody talks about.
So is Marco Gutierrez an outlier in all of this?
I think in terms of being a Hispanic supporter of Donald Trump, probably. But unfortunately, he's not an outlier in the sense that we still have a lot of unresolved racial and class issues in Latin America that we don't talk nearly enough about. You know, I don't think that his views on race and immigration are unique to him. I think, you know, lots of people in Latin America do agree with him, unfortunately. And that is something that we need to tackle, not only in the identity conversation that we're having as a country right now in the U.S., but also in Latin America. I don't think that we're far along over there in that sense at all.
Well, sometimes a taco truck is more than a place for fast food. The World's Maria Muriel, thank you.
Thank you, Marco.
You can get in on this conversation on race in Latin America and assimilation in the States. Search for the Global Nation Exchange on Facebook and share your thoughts with us. Finally today, Labor Day. It's not September 21st, but it always feels like the true finish line of summer. School's back in session, schedules are filling up. Let's face it, everyone's going to be busy. And that means getting dinner on the table can be stressful. Korean-American chef Judy Ju knows what that's like. But she has a set of go-to ingredients to make a quick weeknight supper, Korean style. Let's say she's already got some kimchi at home, maybe some veggies, and I don't know, some leftover chicken. That's a great start. What else does she recommend? Let's go shopping with Judy Ju.
It is 6:30 in the evening on a busy, busy street corner in K-Town, also known as Korea Way in New York City. And this is a little ethnic enclave where I used to hang out, gosh, for centuries, it feels like. But basically, this is a little strip where really Koreans come, and there are tons of restaurants here. There are tons of nightclubs, tons of grocery stores also. But it's bustling. There's so many cars around. There's so many people, and everybody is trying to get into H-Mart, my favorite Korean grocery store, to pick up something to eat, to get home and cook with. So picking up a basket, and I love this store just because I always discover something new. Korean food is so dynamic and everything is always changing. There are always new brands and new products out. So we're walking by the rice, and there are all different types of Korean rice, brown rice, organic brown sweet rice. Health is a major, major concern in Korea too. So you have so many different things that are nutritious for you with lots of different grains, beans and legumes. So I'll probably pick up some of this just to kind of fortify my normal white rice. And then, sorry. And I'm going to make my way, try to find the instant ramen noodle aisle, which is going to be packed full of yummy things. Let's see where we can go. Ooh, passing by the banchan aisle. This is if you're very lazy, but it's all really good if you don't want to make any of your small little side dishes. So whenever you sit down at a Korean meal, usually you'll get this whole array and smattering of free little side dishes, and they're called banchan. And every Korean meal, you have to have maybe at least two or three, but at real big Korean restaurants, you often get like as many as 20 laid out for you, just gracias. So here I am in front of, I don't know, maybe 100 different varieties of instant ramen. So there are many different kinds, but you have to realize that not all instant noodles are created equal. I personally like the Shin Ramyeon, so I'm going to pick this up, and they have a black variety, which is really interesting. I'm going to go for the normal one, or, ooh, actually this one, I like the Pomo one also. I might pick up this one. Ah, here we go. This is the jang aisle with all the basic Korean sauces. And they come in these little rectangle plastic red and brown tubs, and it's called gochujang. Gochu means chili, and jang means paste. And this is basically the most addictive hot sauce that you'll ever try because it's fermented and it's full of umami. It's full of that depth and complexity that everybody loves. So I'm gonna get a box of that, and then I'm also going to pick up something called doenjang, which is fermented soybean paste. And this comes in a similar type box, but it's brown instead because soybeans are brown once they've been dried out. And this is going to add some extra umami also and some saltiness. If you can't find this, you can use red miso. That's absolutely fine, but doenjang is a bit funkier, it's chunkier, it's coarser, it's stronger in flavor. So if you can find the real thing, I would absolutely go for it.
That's Chef Judy Ju in New York City. She told her story to producer Alex Galifant. And that'll do it for us today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Happy Labor Day, and see you back here tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.